The hour of 1 o'clock having arrived, I'll call this meeting of the House Ag Finance and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum, and we will begin with looking carefully over the amendments or the minutes from our meeting on Monday. Representative Burkle, have you had a chance to check those over?
I have, and I'd like to move the minutes from last meeting.
Any additions or corrections? Spellings correct and such? If not, all in favor say aye. And opposed, same sign. The amendments, the minutes are approved. Again, a busy agenda today. We're going to begin with an informational portion and then have a couple of bills. I have a couple, and Representative Burkle has a couple of bills. So first off today, presentation from the poultry industry. And we assume the folks are here. Welcome. And identify yourselves for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Ashley Coles and I serve Minnesota's turkey industry as the executive director for the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. Today is Poultry Day at the Capitol, and I know a number of you have already taken meetings with many of Minnesota's turkey growers. We have a number of turkey growers here in the house today, but not just growers. We have those who support the turkey industry, like veterinarians, processors, and others. So thank you for those who gave time to our members this morning and those who will be meeting with them this afternoon. As many of you may know, Minnesota leads the nation in turkey production, raising approximately 40 million turkeys annually over about 600 turkey farms across the state. The industry contributes more than $16 billion to the state's economy and supports over 51,000 jobs across the state. As you all know, highly pathogenic avian influenza, or HPAI, continues to cause economic strain and emotional hardship for growers and rural communities that they live in. This virus and the growing complexity to its response continues to dominate headlines and policy discussions here in Minnesota and across the country. But while high-path avian influenza commands ongoing attention, a new virus called avian metapneumovirus arrived in Minnesota in the spring of 2024. Avian metapneumovirus is a highly contagious respiratory virus that presents similar to HPAI, but is not classified as a foreign animal disease. When you look at the birds or the number of turkeys impacted, avian metapneumovirus actually has a larger impact on Minnesota's turkey industry than HPAI. It's because of these diseases and the because of diseases like these, it's imperative that agencies like the Board of Animal Health and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture be highest on the priority list when it comes to budget discussions this session. Preemptively, I'd also like to say that Minnesota Turkey Growers Association supports our House File 1101 and House File 979 that you guys will hear later today. While poultry disease is kind of high on our priority list right now, it's not the only priority for our growers. Like many ag sectors, turkey growers and processors struggle to find reliable labor. Policies that support workforce development, like rural infrastructure investment, rural health care, and daycare, are essential for keeping our industry competitive here in Minnesota and across the country. So I have up here also with me Erica Sawatsky. She is a turkey grower here in the state of Minnesota, and so she's also going to share just some information about the turkey industry from her personal perspective.
Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Erica Sawatsky. I'm a sixth-generation turkey farmer from Kensington, and I also serve as a board director on the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. Currently, I am the president on the Board of Animal Health. Being on the board since 2018 has provided many informative updates in regards to highly pathogenic avian influenza, but nothing truly prepares you for having it on your farm. In November of 2023, our worst turkey farming nightmare happened. Over Thanksgiving, we had a barn of very sick turkeys that tested positive for highly pathogenic avian influenza the day after, on Black Friday. When I entered the barn around 7 a.m., I heard silence. There was no clucking, no sneezing, no movement, no feeders running, really no water going into the barn. There's no water consumption. There was not anything going on in the barn, no activity. A silent barn is not only sad, but it's truly very eerie. My father, who has farmed for over 40 years, has never seen turkeys as sick as these. For the next 5 hours, my family worked to pick up dead turkeys, but as every hour progressed, the mortality just increased. We would be carrying dead turkeys to the end of the barn, all the while watching more sick turkeys die as we walked with each pass. The pile of mortality at the end of the barn is one that our farm hadn't seen before. Your heart sinks because you realize seeing turkeys that are this sick, it has to be high path avian influenza. These were our turkeys that we had cared for meticulously from one day old until almost market age, and they were now piled in a heap. It's one of the most difficult things that a farmer will go through and will mentally burden them as they raise the next flock after restocking their farm. Being a board director for the Board of Animal Health and now having boots on the ground perspective allows me to share my experience with you today. We received our test results just a few hours after submitting them. Our flock was depopulated the next day. The depopulation crew were incredibly sincere, knowing the loss and grief that we were experiencing, and handled the process with the utmost care that they could provide. Our compost piles were built the next day. I had many phone calls the day after from the Minnesota Department of Health, epidemiologists, USDA indemnity technicians, our case manager, our compost expert. All of these people were in contact with me over the weekend and evening hours and throughout the next 10 weeks. Our response people are working around the clock, and they have been since 2022. My family and I lived through responding to High Path for a total of 10 weeks, but these people truly live it every day. In the last year, we have seen turkey farms infected later into the summer and later into the winter. We used to believe that High Path was a seasonal virus that followed the spring and fall migration, but it's evident that it's here to stay. This puts a new level of stress on us farmers and the response teams. Ashley had mentioned avian metapneumovirus, and so that's another disease that that I'll just talk about quickly. My flock of turkeys that I restocked after responding to High Path also became positive with avian metapneumovirus. So for me, that was pretty emotional. As you can imagine, your first flock back, and you want to raise a very healthy flock of turkeys, and then they get sick. And that was in April of 2024. So that time of in the industry, it was fairly new. So emotional for me, just because there were a lot of unknowns. The worst day that I had with mortality was over 600 turkeys in a barn. That was difficult, but there are other farmers in our industry that have lost a lot more turkeys than that. It takes hours to clean up a mess like that. So another very challenging disease for us in our industry. Continued support of the Board of Animal Health and the Minnesota Department of Ag needs to continue to be a priority during this session. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. And at this time, I'll take any questions.
Ms. Sawoski, thank you very much for your testimony. It's for folks that don't have livestock or poultry, it's hard to understand the challenges of going in the barn in the morning and not hearing any clucking, as you say, and thank you for your work. Representative Burkle, you've also kind of been through a situation similar to this. Care to comment on how you see things, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In 2015, my farm was positive as well. I can totally relate to the feeling of walking into a barn to silence and spending the next 10 to 12 weeks cleaning up the mess. So can appreciate that for a while, and appreciate as well after conversations I've had with folks at Department of Ag and Board of Animal Health about the work they do, the stress they're under to clean things up. And like you said, Erica, they're there every day doing it. And I know they need that budget to be robust, to say the least, given the circumstances they're working under. So I appreciate your testimony, because I lived it myself personally. And I know that feeling of that first flock back, hoping and doing everything you can to make sure they're healthy. Knock on wood, I've been negative since then. It's been 10 years. I mean, the last year of my RFA loan. Make that payment in July. So we worked our way through it. I would just tell all the growers out there that are fighting with it that you will too.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I have a couple questions, both in your role as a producer, but also on the Board of Animal Health. So I'm looking at where money comes from. So for indemnification or for cleanup costs or for composting, is that state dollars? Is it federal dollars? Is it a combination of both?
Ms. Swatsky.
Chair Anderson and Representative Hansen, the indemnity funding is federal funding. So in terms of response, Dr. Brian Hayes is going to testify later, and he maybe could give you more perspective on the state funding that affects the agency of the Board of Animal Health. But from the grower or producer perspective, the indemnity for the birds that I lose, the cleanup, those costs involved, that's all federal dollars.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do we know, are those funds at risk right now?
So I can answer that question, Chair Anderson.
Go ahead.
Representative Hansen. So they are not currently at risk. And actually, there's been some conversations even as early as this morning or recently as this morning that have ensured that those funds are still part of the whole response for highly pathogenic avian influenza. That indemnity is still very much part of the conversation. Now there's additional components to that conversation, but indemnity and those funds are not at risk.
Thanks, Ms. Coles. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then finally, I was reading a Los Angeles Times article from January that seemed to indicate that turkeys from Minnesota who had been culled made their way in raw pet food to California. And then the federal government at that time in mid-January put some additional rules on for raw pet food. Could you maybe elaborate on how does that happen, or did that happen?
Ms. Coles?
Yeah, so I am Representative Anderson, Representative Hansen. I think the most appropriate person to answer that question is Dr. Hafes, coming up in his team. So.
Okay, I think we can wait with that, Dr. Hafes. Okay. So we will carry that question over to when the Board of Animal Health comes up. Any other questions from members? Just had a quick one. I'll try to say this, the avian metapneumovirus.
Numerus, yeah.
Now, as I understand, there's no indemnity for those losses from the federal government. Is that correct?
Yep, that is, Chair Anderson, that is correct. So highly pathogenic avian influenza is considered a foreign animal disease. Avian metapneumovirus is not, so they don't qualify for the same response funding.
Okay. Thank you very much. See no further questions. Thank you for your testimony. Now we'll have the Board of Animal Health come up, and Dr. Hafes can answer that question. Welcome to the committee, and you want to ask your question right now, Representative?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. Director, I think you may have heard the question on raw pet food and how does that reach. Did that happen with turkeys from Minnesota finding their way into the raw pet food market somehow and then affecting cats in big cats at a zoo?
Dr. Hafes, go ahead.
Chair Anderson, Representative Hansen, yes, some misconceptions around that, but I know what your question is and the topic. So the discovery of H5N1, the virus that causes high path avian influenza, was discovered in some cats, both at large cat sanctuaries out in Oregon and Washington, and Colorado, as well as some domestic cats in Oregon and Colorado. Different introductions, the discovery in those wild cat sanctuaries were through raw meat. Obviously, they don't have commercial diets, but raw meat that was fed to them. Sources of those meat suppliers were a little sketchy at best. Some of the Some of the reports were that they were discarded turkeys, Thanksgiving turkeys that had expired from food shelves and were donated to these facilities. The raw pet food cases were linked directly to a commercial raw pet food company out of Oregon. The interesting part, the part that brings Minnesota into the picture, is the virus strains. So we know a lot about the genotypes, kind of the fingerprint and family tree of these viruses. The strain detected in all these cases was closely related to a couple of strains we had in Minnesota last summer. So the interesting thing is they weren't directly related, but closely related. So as far as regulations around pet food, they're somewhat voluntary at this point out in Oregon. They've asked to restrict some of that diet. The company voluntarily recalled a lot of the pet food. Comments from Minnesota, when I've been asked to comment on the possibility of these birds from Minnesota getting into that stream, those particular cases, it would have been impossible. We know for a fact the birds that were implicated, or the flocks that were implicated, did not make it into general circulation. They were depopulated and disposed of. So, which raises more questions than answers. So how does the virus closely related to our Minnesota cases get into states that far away? And honestly, there's not a lot of answers to that. There's a lot of speculation. I made a point of saying that it's closely related. It's not directly related to the virus that was found in Minnesota, suggesting there's another step in how that was spread. So we could be talking about dairy cattle. We know this is a virus that was circulating in dairy cattle. Potentially there was exposure through some tainted cull dairy cows. Again, I'm speculating because we don't have the answers, but trying to align specifically where that came to, you know, the connection between Minnesota is not a direct route, I guess, is the point I was trying to make on those meetings. The further part of your question is, has that resulted in additional testing, additional restrictions? It has. So the USDA decided to roll out a pilot policy to do additional testing of birds in Minnesota. The testing requires PCR testing, so testing for the actual virus in turkeys that are going to be processed within 72 hours. The only states that this was imposed on were Minnesota and South Dakota. The initial explanation was because Minnesota was overrepresented in indemnity funds that were paid. We're the largest turkey producing state, so we were the most impacted. South Dakota was lumped into that because they had the most repeat farms that were infected. Underlying, I've also been told that it's also directly related to the situation that the virus they found out in the Oregon, Washington, Colorado cats was closely related to Minnesota turkeys. They wanted to make sure that we were doing our due diligence to ensure that product was not making it into the general circulation. We're confident it is not. We're happy to prove that. It is a little bit restricting. 72 hours is a short window of time to get that testing done and get birds to market, especially when we consider weekend shipments and outlying areas of Minnesota.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm assuming we have some limitations on what we could do in terms of interstate commerce and regulation, but that there might be some state might not be a Board of Animal Health thing. Maybe it's more of a commerce or a Department of Ag on pet food regulations. So that might be something we can follow up on later. But I do have a question about, you know, if we go back to mad cow disease and 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago probably now in England, the concern was that, you know, cattle were eating parts of cattle or they were eating manure. And so is there any, and then there was a prohibition on that, that the protein added was not going to be cattle to cattle. Is there a prohibition with poultry on feeding them parts of poultry or poultry manure?
Dr. Hafes?
Chair Anderson, Representative Hansen. So FDA would be who regulates the food aspect, both human and pet food. As far as regulations in Minnesota that we would have pertaining to that, we do have garbage feeding regulations, I guess is the closest I could attribute, where we do not allow people to feed raw raw meat, raw or food that's come into contact with meat without further treatment. Our recommendation for pet food is don't feed raw pet food. It's a guidance. It's a recommendation. We don't have jurisdiction to force that. But aside from highly pathogenic avian influenza being a potential pathogen, there's plenty of other things. And we know that cooking and rendering product eliminates the virus, similar to pasteurization in dairy products. The virus can't withstand those processes.
Thank you very much. Excellent answers to questions. And Dr. Hafes, welcome to the committee. And go ahead with your presentation on how your work is going and the status of your budget. Go ahead.
All right. Thanks again for the opportunity to present to this committee. Again, my name is Dr. Brian Hafes. I'm the state veterinarian for Minnesota, executive director for the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. I just wanted to give you our mission statement, and I'll kind of paraphrase what the mission of our agency is. Our job is to detect, control, and hopefully eradicate disease in animals, both livestock and pets. So just for clarification, we a lot of times get calls about other issues related to animal health, but specifically we're concerned about those diseases that represent issues with commerce as well as issues with human health. Next slide, please. I've been in my role officially since August of 2023. I actually started in interim role in April of 2023, so I'm rounding out my second year as the leader of this agency. Next slide, please. This slide is just to represent a little different setup for our agency. So we are not overseen by a commissioner. We have a board of directors that are appointed by the governor, well-represented members of the state. So we have individuals such as our president, Ms. Swatsky, that is a not only a livestock producer, poultry producer. We have veterinarians that represent swine industry, companion animals, and even aquatics. Representatives that are representing cattle industry, the swine industry, and we have a member of the Shakopee Minwakaton Sioux community representing our tribal members. Non-emergency priorities. So these are not to under-signify these diseases or these situations, but things that are on our plate. They're not our day-to-day activities, but things that keep popping up that we are charged with keeping track of. The first one, African swine fever. This is one that I've talked about with this committee in the past. The bullet point there says monitoring sightings on our northern border. That doesn't mean we have African swine fever on our northern border. That's a reminder that we're nervous about feral swine coming down from Canada. So the magic combination for African swine fever getting introduced into a country is a feral swine population and swill feeding, so untreated garbage feeding of pigs. So very, very concerned about the presence of feral swine. We do not have feral swine in Minnesota. We do a great job of monitoring any sightings, tracking those down, working with the DNR to make sure that we eliminate the possibility of a feral swine herd developing in Minnesota. Another thing about African swine fever, just kind of recent, this is it, within the last couple of years, this has arrived in our hemisphere. So prior to this, we assumed the oceans were keeping us a little distant from it, but we had an incursion in Haiti and the Dominican Republic a couple years ago, and the proximity to some of our Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands makes us nervous because the implications of the virus getting into those territories also applies to the continental United States. So there are provisions in place to somewhat regionalize those islands if they would happen to get the virus. In the meantime, our partners with USDA have done a great job of evaluating the feral swine populations on those islands and doing what needs to be done to avoid spread. I say that, and I'll tell you, I lie awake at night when I hear there's another hurricane coming through the Caribbean, because all it takes is a hurricane, a tsunami, or something to wash some of those pigs north, and suddenly we're in a world of hurt. Our southern states, unfortunately, do have sustained populations of feral swine, and the concern is real that the proximity to Haiti and the Dominican Republic is just a little too close. So one of those diseases that's constantly on our radar, constantly We are in preparation mode in case we have to respond to it. Rabies. We've had a significant uptick in rabies cases over the past year and a half, attributed primarily to our warm winters. So this virus is primarily spread in skunks and bats in Minnesota. And with the mild winters, those species have had the opportunity to survive. And with that, the virus has survived. So a larger number of cases than we usually see, both in those wild species, but also domestic species. And unfortunately, we even had a report of a human case, fatality last summer. Tularemia is another one of those diseases that we work closely with the Department of Health on. This is a disease, typically we would see this in rabbits. That's the species that carries this bacteria and spreads it. Typically from there, we would see it in cats. This year we've seen 27 cases, or I should say last year, 27 cases. I think a couple more have been reported already this winter. The interesting thing is all of these cases have been in the metro area. So these have been in Hennepin and Ramsey County. So just a reminder that these rabbits are around. They're endemic, I guess you could say, in the Twin Cities metro area. There's a concern with this because it is zoonotic. So people are able to contract this disease as well. Historically, we would see this in people that hunted rabbits. So cleaning the rabbits, they would contract the bacteria while they were cleaning their rabbits. Kennels have been keeping us busy as well, investigating additional complaints against kennels and kind of working within our scope of authority. We've actually bolstered our companion animal program in a couple ways, both with the additional member to our board of directors who represents companion animal veterinarians. We've also hired an additional field veterinarian who is specifically charged with investigations related to our companion animal programs. Farm Survey Program has experienced a little more work with the exclusionary fencing requirements. So our staff has been auditing the requests for exemptions, as well as understanding what types of exclusionary fences the producers are asking for approval on. Next slide. Immediate concerns. I'm going to start with the bottom and then move to the top. So a couple of diseases that have come out just recently. So this is basically since December. We are hearing about New World screwworm. So this is a parasite that has been eradicated from the United States since I think it was the 60s that we last saw this. This is an interesting disease. It's a parasite. So we're concerned about the maggots of this particular fly because it likes to feed on living tissue. So we think of maggots feeding primarily on dead tissue. The screwworm maggot feeds on living tissue and any living tissue. So this is a concern because it was recently detected in southern Mexico. Prior to that, it had been basically shoved to Central America, Southern America as the closest area of infection. So a lot of work has gone into controlling that, bolstering the eradication in that region. So USDA has set up some additional laboratories to assist with that. The interesting thing about the screwworm fly is it's the main method of eradicating it is through reproduction, decreased reproduction. So the female screwworm fly breeds once and lays her eggs. So if she mates with a sterile male fly, she lays infertile eggs. So the eradication efforts are releasing as many sterile male flies as possible down in Panama and southern Mexico. The concern about this isn't so much that we're going to have a screwworm epidemic in Minnesota, probably too cold for those flies to survive up here, but what happens in the southern U.S. affects what happens in Minnesota relative to our livestock commodities. So if our country becomes infected with this particular parasite, then we are considered a carrier of that, and it really hinders our ability to do international commerce. The next one, foot and mouth disease, a recent discovery in Germany. So we haven't had foot and mouth disease in the United States for decades. It's a disease that affects multiple species. Cloven-hoofed species are susceptible, so we're talking cattle, pigs, sheep, and goats. A very, very infectious disease has devastating ramifications on those species, lack of gain, mortalities for sure. And it's another one of those reportable diseases that the international community pays very close attention to and affects our ability to do commerce. My concern about that one is that it has arrived in Germany. So a trading partner of ours, a country that we do a lot of commerce with, and the concern about it is how did it get there? They don't know how it got there. So it was detected in, of all things, water buffalo farm, privately owned water buffalo farm that I think they had a dozen animals or so that they were raising for a variety of reasons, but they don't know how it got there, and that's a concern. If we don't know how to track this virus, we're in trouble. The other thing about this one is the rapid speed of infection. So this virus infects animals before you know it. I had an opportunity to do some training at Plum Island Research Facility on some of these reportable diseases, and this was one of the ones we were able to spend some time looking at. And we had a room of cattle, sheep, and pigs. No one was in contact with each other, but they injected one pig, and by the end of the week, all the animals were euthanized because they had developed the disease. So very rapid spread and without much of a reservoir needed. Our immediate concerns that you're probably mostly aware with are highly pathogenic avian influenza, H5N1 in dairy cattle, and avian metapneumovirus. And I'll go into a little more detail on those. So just specific semantics, I guess, on how we name these things. H5N1 is the name of the virus that causes highly pathogenic avian influenza. We refer to it as such, high path avian influenza, HPAI, in poultry. In dairy cattle, we refer to it as H5N1, just so we have distinction of what disease we're talking about. High path avian influenza, you heard from the previous people that this is a round-the-clock surveillance effort for the industry as well as the Board of Animal Health. So we are continually monitoring our phones and lab reports on suspicious mortality rates or just signs of the disease. Typically, this is our off-season for high path avian influenza. This virus is primarily spread with the migratory waterfowl being the main components of the spread. So why is it here in the middle of the winter? And I think, again, we can attribute some of that to the mild winters. Birds aren't moving away as quickly, but I think it's also probably more of an indication that this virus is here. We can no longer refer to this as a foreign animal disease. This virus is endemic. It's seeded down somehow in the environment and is causing infections year-round. Currently, we're preparing for the spring wave, so we still assume that that migratory pattern is what's going to bring the most virus to the area. So end of March is typically when the season starts for high path. The cost to respond in 2024 was roughly $600,000 in board salary. The previous year was about $450,000. So that's just salary. That's not referring to the testing and some of the other things that are part of that response. In dairy cattle, so H5N1 did a strange thing and decided to infect another species. Up to this point, we had incidental findings of H5N1 in species, nothing that really was spread from there. It was considered an incidental finding. We weren't spreading it that way. But then in the spring of 24, the B313 strain was detected in dairy cattle in Texas and found to be very infectious. This virus had a affinity for the mammary tissue and milk in particular. So we saw this virus spread just by the movement of cattle. It was considered a single introduction, a single spillover event in dairy cattle in Texas. And from there, we saw it spread to, I believe it was 14 total states, including Minnesota. The frustrating thing with that is that virus still was very infectious to poultry. So we know the strain that was circulating in poultry last summer was also this B313 strain. And we know it came from dairy cattle. This strain was never found in migratory waterfowl. Fast forward to this year, we are dealing with a new strain. So as we know, influenza viruses change. This the strain that we're dealing with now is the D1.1 strain. So this one has been seen in migratory waterfowl. We heard reports from Alaska that it was coming our way. We saw some of our counterparts out on the West Coast dealing with it initially, and then sure enough, it showed up in Minnesota in November. Right now, we've had, I think it's 12 or 13 cases since November of highly pathogenic avian influenza in poultry. That's a mix of backyard flocks and commercial flocks. And I believe all but one or two of those has been the D1.1 strain. I bring this up because we were kind of hoping that the dairy situation had run its course and it wasn't an issue. And then Nevada reported dairy cases that were positive for this D1.1 strain. So now we're in a whole new game. Prior to this, we thought we could isolate, we could control this virus by maintaining some distance from our poultry. But now, knowing that it also infects migratory birds, wild birds, it's a different game as far as response to the disease. USDA has instituted a national milk surveillance program, so we're required all states to submit milk samples from a representative sample of the dairies to determine if there is virus circulating in your state in dairy cattle. The Department of Agriculture is heading that up. Their jurisdiction is over liquid milk. If they get a positive report, then we take over the response as the Board of Animal Health. So similar to our IPATH response in poultry, we're the agency that is charged with responding to disease in livestock. We work very closely with our Department of Ag counterparts, the USDA. Local staff has been instrumental, as well as the Department of Health. We're concerned about this virus because it also has been known to infect people. This D1.1 strain has shown an affinity for more than just poultry, which has always been the concern that this influenza could become more infectious to people. To date, the people that have been infected have, for the most part, been mildly infected, but we do have a couple of fatalities that were somewhat attributed to this infection. Avian metapneumovirus. Real quickly, this is the great mimicker, the great exaggerator. So 871 positive case reports since April. That's an underestimate. A lot of producers recognize that when their birds have signs of illness, if it's negative for high path avian influenza, it's likely avian metapneumovirus. As was discussed previously, this is not an indemnified disease. It's not considered a reportable disease at the national level, so it does not garner the same support financially. I would say it has probably caused more devastation than high path this year. Next. This is just to kind of give you an overview of where my staff is at. So we're really looking at the third consecutive year of dealing with highly pathogenic avian influenza. It started back in 22. We had a little reprieve that summer, but it just has continued to pop up. We're not getting the break from it like we used to. So we depend heavily on our federal counterparts. And as you know, that's a stressor these days with the questions revolving around what the new administration is doing with federal staff. We work hard to make sure that we are able to provide the same level of support to our producers, as well as continue doing the same day-to-day activities that are expected of the board. And then the last point I just want to drive home to. We certainly know this is a devastating disease to our producers. Our staff is affected by this as well. We did not get into this business to learn how to depopulate and dispose of animals. Our job our passion has always been to save animals, keep animals healthy. So this is very stressful on our producers as veterinarians and veterinary assistants. Where does this lead us? Less than 0.02% of the state budget is allocated to the Board of Animal Health. We receive about 20% of our funding from USDA funds, cooperative agreement funds primarily. These are not guaranteed every year. So we're concerned where the cooperative agreement funds will go, if we'll have the same level or if we'll have them at all. Currently, there is a freeze, as you know, on a lot of the federal spending, this being among them. So we have received some pre-approval letters on certain cooperative agreement funds. Others, we have not. And typically, we would have those by now, knowing that we could use those for the the spring outbreak of high path avian influenza for testing and other things. Just another point, this disease is not going away. It's here to stay, and I think we need to approach it as such. It's no longer a foreign animal disease. It's a domestic disease that is in need of more control. I think that that'll wrap up my presentation. Just to reemphasize the stress and the resources that are needed to maintain this level of response for this length of time.
Thank you, Dr. Hayes. I have a question from Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Department, for that presentation. My question is on slide 9, specifically about testing of raw milk for H5N1 avian influenza. The department put on a really great virtual event going over the plan of that in January that I was able to attend virtually. It was very, very helpful. But then a couple of weeks after that online event, we got an email that said, I just want to read from this email that was sent out, the state's plan is part of a nationwide testing strategy that is mandated and financially supported by the USDA. While we had hoped to roll out testing in February, the MDA is still working to finalize funding agreements with the federal government. Since we do not have agreements finalized, the testing rollout will not begin at the start of February. Thankfully, there's been an update since then that I believe this week testing has started. But even in that update, it simply says that a preliminary funding agreement with USDA makes this testing program possible. I'm hoping you can help highlight what a preliminary funding agreement means. Has the department received those funds from the federal government or not at this point, even though the program, as we speak, is being implemented?
I think Ms. Medina can answer that, or Dr. Hayes.
I can answer.
Okay.
Yeah. Chair Anderson, Representative Smith. So the funds were put on hold as part of this spending freeze by the federal government. The pre-approval, I think is what you're referring to, has been issued. So the way these funds work, they act as a reimbursement. So that being said, we were confident that we received notice, and I guess I'm referring to the Department of Agriculture. We work closely with them on this strategy, but they received notice that they would be funded for the dairy surveillance. So that's what initiated us to get this started sooner rather than later. We started on Monday with our first samples being collected and submitted for testing. The reimbursement will come after we get the bills, so to speak, for that. Some of the testing is already covered by USDA. It didn't require additional funding from them. This is more to cover supplies, shipping, those kinds of things. We wanted to ensure that would be there. We also had some emergency funds that we were able to rely on if those didn't come through in a timely fashion.
Representative Smith?
Chair, you anticipated my question because as they are reimbursements, if those funds do not come, I mean, we're going to talk about emergency funds that we're going to help with the Board of Animal Health and what the right level for that is a little later in this committee. But you anticipated that secondary question. My only follow-up question is about specifically USDA federal workers, which we do have in our state. Are there sort of in a larger viewpoint from your departments, how many that's a too specific question. USDA permanent employees, particularly maybe those that are now laid off because they are probationary for some purpose, how many of those are involved specifically in the testing of H5N1, both in raw milk but also across the various programs that we have to do to maintain what we can tabs on this disease?
Dr. Hayes?
Chair Anderson, Representative Smith, great question and a question that concerns us. So locally, we have about a dozen USDA staff that are housed in Minnesota that we rely heavily on. I would say about a third of our work we share with them. They've been a very instrumental partner in just our day-to-day activities, certainly on responses to these kinds of things. We do know that two members of their staff were released, and then one of them actually was recalled as an accidental termination. So they're down one locally. That also doesn't reflect the hiring freeze they're on. So even though they lost only one, there's still vacancies they're not allowed to fill. At the national level, we have concerns because there was also terminations of some of the individuals at the National Veterinary Service Lab that does our testing, our confirmation testing on this. So. And then beyond that, there's people doing research on vaccines and things like that are affecting us at the national level, not just Minnesota. But in in our local assets as far as USD are concerned. One individual has been let go, but there's still questions about, you know, every day is a new question. What does this mean? Give me five things that you did last week. So that could have more effect, more ramifications. So we're also concerned about the level of service they'll be able to provide us as the state. So I work very closely with the area vet in charge for the USDA. She's concerned that the level of support that they've been able to provide through the years to the Board of Animal Health will be limited just because of some of the new federal restrictions.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question relates to your employees, the employees that are working in the farms, the farmers, the people that are working in the processing plants. So if we have viruses that are mutating or evolving or whatever you want to call it, and they have the potential to jump into the human population, your staff or the people working with poultry or the people working with the dairy may be the ones that have the potential for picking that up. So first, I'd like to know what you're doing for protection of your staff that are working in these environments.
Dr. Hayes?
Chair Anderson, Representative Hansen, excellent question, excellent point. So we know the cases in humans across the country primarily are those individuals working with depopulation efforts or working directly with the sick animals. So yes, our staff are in the line of fire. I don't want to make it sound like it's a very instant infection. It's still a pretty low infection rate, but we are concerned about that with the proximity to the sick and dying animals. So we work very closely with our Department of Health to make sure we're monitoring all the workers on site. That includes the industry or producers as well as our staff. So we make sure we're maintaining contact with them, questioning how are you feeling, what are any physical signs that we need to know about, as well as PPE. So we're ensuring that PPE is available for both our staff as well as the individuals working on those farms.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up to that, so your staff may have union protection, biomonitoring, or other things as part of their contracts. For the workers that are on the farm or the farmers that are having exposure, is there any voluntary testing available, biomonitoring for this, or is it just I'm not feeling well, I need to go to the doctor? What is the interaction for the workers on the farm and then in the processing plants?
Chair Anderson, Representative Hansen, we have the Department of Health embedded in our emergency response team. So they're on site, or I shouldn't say on site, but they're actively asking for lists of people that are working on that farm and to give them options for testing, free testing. Confidential testing. So we have a lot of concerns with some of our migrant workers. They're concerned about being public with their presence on some of those farms. So their Department of Health is very good at explaining that this is all confidential. You don't have to worry about this being reported somewhere, I guess, basically. Additionally, PPE is provided through Department of Health. They're very, very proactive about doing that. Minnesota is actually recognized as probably being the state that's best at getting PPE out and getting the testing done. So that's completely the reason why we have Department of Health on the team, to make sure that we are addressing those concerns with the potential infection in people.
Representative Hansen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And finally, in about 6 weeks, there will start to be about thousands of Minnesotans that will go into the field attempting to hunt poultry, not always being successful, but they will have contact with turkeys. They will be out in the field, they may see dead wild turkeys, etc. What are your efforts in terms of outreach, reaching Minnesotans who may not normally be having the protections that the workers or your workers do, but are coming in contact in the field?
Dr. Hayes.
Chair Anderson, Representative Hansen, we work very closely with our friends at Department of Natural Resources to make sure that word is getting out. There's also some hunter killed testing that's available to those people that are out duck hunting, goose hunting. I just want to point out one interesting thing. So I don't know that I've heard of a wild turkey testing positive to this virus yet. So, and I've asked that question every time I get the opportunity, And I have not gotten an explanation why the wild turkeys seem to be able to survive this. Probably we're just not finding some of those that are dying from it. I would suspect some of them are adapting their immune system to respond. But just an aside, I know that wasn't your question, but...
Seeing no further questions, I want to thank you, Dr. Hayes, for the work you do and also the people on your staff.
Thank you.
Just a heads up that we do have a hard ending time at 2:45 today. Another committee has to be coming in at that time. So we will probably be coming back this evening at the call of the chair approximately 6:30. I don't think we're going to get done today unless we go through these. We got a couple of bills to hear and have some amendments. So. Just be ready to come back tonight at the call of the chair, probably back here about 6:30. Have a couple of bills up now. I'm going to take the table and have Vice Chair Harder come up.
Okay, our next item of business is House File 979. Chair Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Vice Chair Harder. I'd like to move House File 979.
Chair Anderson moves House File 979 to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Chair Anderson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair. This bill, as you can see, is very simple. I do believe we have an amendment, too, but... In all candor, this is going to be a vehicle bill. We just wanted to get this bill out there. And as you've heard today, that we are very in tuned to the needs of the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Ag as well. So, again, as we've heard, there are questions about funding at the state level and also services from the federal level. So we feel we're going to leave the appropriation blank for now, but just be confident that we will be taking care of the financial needs of the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Agriculture. So we can take a look at that amendment now.
Chair Anderson, maybe please do the testifiers first.
Pardon?
Do the testifiers first.
Oh, okay. You're in charge.
Well, thank you. Our first testifier is Hunter Peterson, Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Hunter Peterson, Public Policy Specialist with Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation, here today in support of House File 979. And if it's okay with you, Madam Chair, I'm also going to just briefly comment on in support of House File 1101. Obviously, Minnesota's livestock industry is a cornerstone of our state's economy. In 2023, livestock cash receipts in Minnesota totaled $8.4 billion, seventh highest in the country. Minnesota's number one in turkeys, number two in hogs, and seventh in milk production. The ability to effectively respond to animal disease outbreaks and biosecurity threats is critical to maintaining a strong and resilient agricultural sector. Again, the Board of Animal Health plays a vital role in disease prevention, surveillance, and rapid response to outbreaks that threaten our livestock, food supply, and economy. While Minnesota Farm Bureau appreciates the operating adjustment of $367,000 in the FY26-27 biennium for the Board in the Governor's budget recommendations, we believe a greater increase in funding is warranted. In our view, with the constant, ever-evolving threats of avian influenza and other animal diseases, the Board needs robust financial support for personnel and resources to ensure that Minnesota's agriculture industry remains prepared in the face of animal health challenges. And to the Agricultural Emergency Account, it also serves as a crucial financial resource in times of crisis, enabling a swift and coordinated response to animal health emergencies. And without sufficient funds in this account, our state risks delays in disease containment, increased economic losses for farmers, and potential threats to public health. So I'd like to thank Chair Anderson for his leadership on this issue, and I urge the committee to support both House File 979 and House File 1101. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Hunter Peterson. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Peterson? Seeing none. Okay, we'll go on to our next testifier, which is Stu Laurie from Minnesota Farmers Union. Please come to the testifier's table, state your name, and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Harder and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stu Laurie, Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union, and on behalf of our organization, I'm glad to share our strong support for HF 979 and strong funding for the Board of Animal Health. Just two quick points to build on the conversation that we've had today, but from our perspective, the Board of Animal Health does an excellent job. They make incredibly important but also consequential and difficult decisions for farmers, and in our experience they do so in a way that's both expeditious but also brings farmers in and helps them understand why those decisions are being made, why they need to make difficult actions like depopulation or understand things like testing. Just recently they were on a call that we had with our county officers and spent a bunch of time helping us understand what they're up to and why it's important. Second, just make the point that this work matters to all farmers. Farmers Union represents, large commercial livestock producers. We also have a lot of folks who are doing like my folks, who have some chickens in the backyard, and these are really consequential decisions to all of them. I think about when maybe the same articles that you were reading, Representative Hansen, my mom texted him to me and said, what are we going to do with my sister-in-law's chickens? And I sent her a bulletin from the Board of Animal Health, hugely, hugely important. I'll also end by echoing some of the comments from Mr. Peterson talking about the value of the livestock industry. I remember when I started with Farmers Union, a senior member of our organization sat down and talked about the value of livestock, and he said, Stu, you got to remember when we lose a dairy, it's not just losing a dairy. It's potentially losing the veterinarian, the air duct installer, all the folks who are coming out. If someone was driving down our driveway growing up, more likely than not, it was because of our livestock. It's what brought us together as a community. Hugely important. I'll also take this opportunity to share our support for HF 1101 and support for the Ag Emergency Account, which is critical for our state's response, as is the board. So thank you for the opportunity to testify and value any questions.
Does anyone have any questions for Stu Laurie? Seeing none, we will thank you. We will move to our amendments. So Representative Hansen has the A1 amendment. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Anderson, I think we can get done before 2:45. So I'm optimistic.
Okay.
I move the A1 and ask for a roll call. And, I appreciate the testimony, and I think that after the presentations we've heard, it's very important. It's also very important that we need to be working on this human side of it as well, both for the farmers, the farm workers, the staff, the people in the processing plants dealing with this. So the support for the Board of Animal Health in your bill and the vehicle is a dot, dot, dot. Could be less, could be more, unknown. So what the A1 amendment does is it puts the numbers in there from the governor's budget, but it also increases the ag emergency response above that, so the million each year, and then making sure that that's working with people. So we've heard I wouldn't say maybe the anxiety, but the uncertainty of what can happen federally. And if we have to have PPE for workers, if we have to be working with the farmers and getting that out, if there's a need and we can't fund that federally, I think we need to have these dollars there. So I move the A1 and ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, Chair Anderson, would you? Chair Anderson, do you wish to respond?
Yeah, I appreciate the sentiment, Representative Hansen, and I agree we need to fund this. And it's my pledge to this committee and to the state and the Department of Ag that we will fully fund the Board of Animal Health. But I think at this time, with the uncertainties that we've talked about, putting an exact number on that, which could be changed in the future, but again, I would feel more comfortable leaving the appropriation open And we do have a separate bill coming up just after this, which also deals with the emergency account. So at this time, I would recommend a no vote from members.
Did you have anything else? Chair Hansen, did you have anything else to say?
Ask for your support and a reminder of the roll call.
All right, then. A roll call having been requested, the committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Anderson, no.
Representative Harder?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Representative Agbaje?
Yes.
Representative Burkle?
No.
Representative Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Gander?
No.
Representative Jacob?
No.
Representative Lawrence?
No.
Representative Lee?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Vang?
Yes.
With six ayes and seven nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against House File 979? Is there any further discussion on House File 979? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll keep trying to improve bills as they go forward, but it's important to get the vehicle, so I would recommend a yes vote.
Chair Hansen, do you have anything concluding comments on your bill?
Please vote yes. Thank you.
Chair, can I have a quick clarifying question?
Representative Smith.
Chair, could you just repeat, what is the motion on the table? This is going to Ways?
Yes. Yes, this will go to Ways and Means.
Just want a clarification, thanks.
All those in favor of House File 979, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion carries. All right, our next item of business is House File 1101. Chair Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
I would move House File 1101. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Anderson moves House File 1101. Chair Anderson, please present your bill.
Madam Chair, again, this really ties in well with the discussion about the Board of Animal Health. This agricultural emergency account can play a key role in helping to fund activities that need to be undertaken. A little bit of history on the account. It dates back to 2016, following the first outbreak of bird flu back in 2015. The account received an initial infusion of $1 million, and that remained that way until 2022, when $4 million was added to the account. And currently, as of the latest accounting I have, the account's balance stands at $1.2 million. And what this bill would do would be to add $1.5 million to the Ag Emergency Account 2026 that begins July 1st. And Madam Chair, that is what the bill does, and I would again ask for member support.
All right. Thank you, Chair Anderson. Are there any questions on the bill from members? Seeing none, Representative Hansen has the A1 amendment. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A1 amendment and ask for a roll call. Maybe we'll have better luck on this one, Chair Anderson. We've just had testimony about the need. We also have, the uncertainty at the federal level. So what this amendment does is it provides money. There's $4 million sitting in the dairy line item that has not been used. There is no sign of a farm bill coming at any time soon. If we go into a budget crisis, unexpended money is often at risk. So I think it's an appropriate use to take 1.5 million from that 4 million. That still leaves 2.5 million in there. And it would be transferred and allow for immediate testing of food. So we have had discussions about on-the-farm testing of liquid milk, but we have not talked about the retail. And in order to, again, be checking on human consumption, we need to have some of that. We need to start looking at that in terms of the ag emergency response so we can see what the potential risk is. So I would ask for your support of the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Do members have any questions? Seeing none, Chair Anderson, please respond.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. And bear with me, Representative Hansen. The dairy funding was set aside a couple of years ago, and I've discussed this with the dairy people, and they're hopeful. I agree that we don't have a farm bill yet, but the House passed a budget bill last evening in Washington, and now it's going to go to the Senate. And what I was told that when they finish this tax bill out there, they're going to get at the farm bill. But again, that's just one person's opinion. So I have some confidence that the farm bill will be done in the next several months, and we've kept that money aside for the dairymen and pledged to keep it that way. So I don't like to take that source of funding. And the other thing about your amendment, the statute calls for the money to be used for ag emergencies that affect the producers of livestock, poultry, crops, and other farm commodities. So not quite sure if we could take this money to begin testing food. I think we'd have to get some clarification of that from nonpartisan staff. But as of right now, again, Madam Chair, I would recommend a no vote. This bill would get funding to the Ag Emergency Account at the beginning of the 2026 fiscal year, and I would ask for a no vote.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. A roll call being requested. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Anderson, no.
Representative Harder?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Representative Agbaje?
Yes.
Representative Burkle?
No.
Representative Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Gander?
No.
Representative Jacob?
No.
Representative Lawrence?
No.
Representative Lee?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Vang?
Yes.
All right, there being 6 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. So members, Mr. Peterson testified on this bill previously. Is there anyone in the audience who would wish to testify for or against House File 1101? I'm not seeing anything. Is there anyone, any other members that would like to testify or like to have any comment or discussion on this bill? Any comment? Seeing none, Chair Anderson, do you have any concluding comments on your bill?
I would just encourage support for the bill. It provides money for the Ag Emergency Account, which is critical to our efforts to work with the Board of Animal Health and Department of Health in terms of keeping a vigilant watch on livestock diseases. So again, I would just encourage your support.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. House File 1101 is laid over and will be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Our next item of business is the depredation reports from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Please take a seat at the table, identify yourself, and begin your presentation.
Go ahead. All right. My name is Mark Abrahamson. I'm the Plant Protection Director at the Department of Agriculture. So Plant Protection, we oversee both the wolf depredation and elk damage claims. So There is a lot of detail in the slides, but I'm going to give you an expedited presentation, really just hitting the high points here. So detail is there, and happy to answer questions about it. So we're going to talk about three reports that we submit to the legislature. Two of them we report on every year. So these are submitted in December, and they're basically financial reports on claims that have been paid out for both wolf and elk damages. And then the third was a one-time report we submitted in February this year on recommendations specific to survey day and damage and options for reduction. Good. Okay, so wolf, talk through wolf and elk and then cervid. So wolf, simply, we have the authority, Department of Ag, to compensate livestock owners who lose livestock to wolf, which has been around for about 50 years. Good. There's a process which is works very well, and the key there is we have a very good field support system for investigating these claims. So investigators are conservation officers from the DNR, staff from USDA APHIS Wildlife Services. We have one sheriff's department, Kitson County, which is authorized to investigate claims. All of these investigators work under the guidance of Wildlife Services, so they are the key coordinator of all of this and coordinate all the damage. The key is it's a really good system for evaluating what is from wolf and what is from other causes. Go ahead. 2010-2011 is the first year that I can see that we had a specific appropriation for paying wolf damages. It's varied over the years. Thing I wanted to bring up on this slide is that we also get federal dollars in many years through the Fish and Wildlife Service. So they have a grant that's available to states to help with compensation and prevention of wolf depredation. It's competitive. We don't get it every year, but many years we have some federal dollars that supplement our state program. Good. The trend has been upward, particularly the last couple of years. So this graph is just showing the depredation claim payments per year along with number of claims. And so the past 2 years, we've had high numbers of claim payments exceeding the cap or exceeding our appropriation of 175, both the last couple of years. I didn't get it worked into this slide, but what you don't see is that we have about $20,000 that are on our backlog to pay next fiscal year in July 2026. So when we run out of money, we basically hold the claims and pay them, we have money again. Good. Okay, and then in addition to compensation, we also can work with producers on prevention. So these are through grants, fences, shelters, guard animals, et cetera. We have had some state dollars that have been appropriated for that that purpose over the years. We also, this is something we can get federal funds to help with as well. So for the past 7 years, more or less, we've been able to have an annual grant program for producers to take advantage of opportunities to try and prevent wolf depredation. Okay, so that was a whirlwind on wolf. Elk. Again, in statute, we have the authority to pay producers who have damage to crops or fences that are surrounding crops or pastures from elk. This, for the most part, only applies to northwest Minnesota, which is where we have elk herds in Minnesota. Every once in a while, there will be an elk that shows up in another part of the state that we might have some damage from, but by and large, this is mostly concentrated just in a couple of few counties in northwest Minnesota. This process, kind of similar to wolf, but it's a little bit different in that there is a little bit more that goes into the field evaluation because it's not simply someone who can say that, yes, elk caused this damage, but there is also a need to say, here's how much damage there was at this site at the time of a field visit. So we need somebody who's got a pretty comprehensive set of skills there in order to evaluate these claims. But then again, once those claims are evaluated, they come into the department and we process them for the claimants. Good. Over the years, this was first enacted in 87, and just worth noting a couple of things. One, there's a $20,000 per year limit on how much a producer can be compensated. That was actually put in the statute in 1987, so it's a long time ago. $20,000 doesn't go as far as it used to. Just noteworthy. One other thing I just mention is that we went about 20 years with County Extension up in northwest Minnesota handling the field work for us. But through staffing changes in 2017, we lost that resource, and we went to crop adjusters as basically who we rely on to do this field evaluation, who in statute are described as approved agents. So basically, if we have a crop adjuster who's had training for Wildlife Services on documenting elk damage, we've used them as an approved agent. Okay, good. Another table here on appropriations, again, 2010, 2011, the first year we had a specific appropriation that I can find for elk. And the years, or the amount has changed over the years. The one thing I'll point out is we have, over the last several years, had some additional ways to use the money. One of the key things was, one, we made that switch from county extension to the crop adjusters. We needed to compensate them for their time. So that was starting in 2018, 2019. It's been pretty cheap. Like, this has been a very lean program. It doesn't cost a lot of money to have the crop adjusters doing these claim evaluations. And then lastly, I'll just mention, we also got authority to do grants for the last couple of biennial. We haven't had any producers who have taken us up on that yet, but we're hopeful that that's something we can eventually get going here to help reduce some of the damages in some certain situations. Okay, there's another graph on the amounts over time. So again, trending upward over the years, but for the last several years, we've been exceeding the amount appropriated for damage claims. And again, we're backlogged. So in 2024, we ran out of money in May. We had claims that we carried over to July. So we spent the money for 2025 pretty quickly, right away at the beginning of the fiscal year. And we now have a backlog that's going to carry over to 2026 of about $45,000 in claims. So that has been the trend there.
Good.
There are a few different herds, and I'll just mention here that location has a big impact on how much damage can occur. So with the Grigola herd, for instance, we've had very little submitted in claims over the last several years. Kitson Central and the Caribou Vita more so, particularly Kitson Central.
Good.
Here are the types of situations where we have damage. So fence, stored forage, and standing crop. You can see, by and large, standing crop is the bulk of the financial damage that's occurring. In a particular year, there might be more or less in stored forage, but every year it's consistent standing crop. The other thing I wanted to mention is just that we also have losses that are not getting compensated every year. So these are losses that producers are having that are over the 20K. Okay, here's not a totally comprehensive, but a map showing elk programs across the country. And so all the blue squares are states that have elk and have a program related to abating damage. Where there's green, it's a state that also has compensation. So you can see Minnesota and Wisconsin stand out in the eastern side of the country in that we're the only two states that have any compensation available for producers. One other thing that's just worth noting is Minnesota, to my knowledge, is the only state where the Department of Agriculture has anything to do with elk in terms of like compensation or abatement. And that does bring up something as part of our recommendations. Okay, so then moving into the survey impact. So this is information from the report that the department submitted. As I said, I'm just going to go through this fairly quickly. So these are the different types of situations for both elk and white-tailed deer where we've got damage. Fencing from elk, but then field crops, stored forage, and fruit and vegetable crops, both deer and elk. For elk, I'm sure they would love fruit and vegetable crops, but we just don't have them in the locations where we have them currently in the state, so I'm mostly worried about deer. So a few examples. The report does a good job of kind of documenting a few producer examples of the damage they're experiencing and impact on their operations. So stored forage has one. Good. Standing crops, so some harvest maps showing the losses experienced the yield, and I think these are soybeans from deer. And then vegetable farms, of course, deer love vegetable farms and gardens, so a big problem also. Okay, and so there are some abatement programs currently for trying to deal particularly with deer, but also elk. So there is hunting, so obviously deer hunting is a big topic in Minnesota, but elk. There is also some limited opportunities for hunting elk, limited by the size of the herds. DNR has a wildlife damage program that can help producers with abatement, removal permits, antlerless permits, et cetera.
Good.
So then getting into recommendations, and there we worked closely with both DNR and also stakeholder groups to prepare this report. So we have recommendations from all those parties that are part of this report. Today, I'm going to focus mainly on the recommendations from agriculture, as I'm most familiar with those. For elk, one of the main things we really need to shore up is our ability to evaluate the claims. We have been relying on crop adjusters. We started out with five people who were interested. Eventually, we got down to one. We've now lost our last crop adjuster who was interested and doing this. It's you know, just another thing on top of everything else and a side gig for these folks. So we have a temporary agreement with USDA APHIS Wildlife Services to provide that field evaluation component for us. We're hoping that's something that we can build into more of a long-term partnership, but it's going to cost more money than the few thousand dollars we've got by in past years paying adjusters on these one-off claim evaluations. I mentioned having agriculture as having the compensation, but abatement is in DNR's hands. It's a little bit weird. And the way that statute reads now, there's no requirement for any abatement procedures on the part of a producer. So there could be an opportunity, say, offered by DNR to take some measures for abatement, and the resources have been limiting, but let's say if the resources were greater, at this point in time, a producer could simply refuse to take advantage of those and continue to get compensation payments. So we think it would be a good measure to have a stronger link between abatement being just an integral part of compensation. Not that we're looking to not compensate people, but if there's an opportunity for abatement and resource to pay for it, it's important that we take advantage of that. The $20,000 cap, as I mentioned, that's been around since 1987. We know we have people who have losses that go on top of that, so that's an issue. An easy thing would just be to simply take that general fund appropriation and transfer it to an agricultural fund so that if we did have a light year, which would be fortunate, we would have some money that could carry over to a subsequent year and potentially help to cover a heavy burden. So just not having the money go away at the end of the biennium. And then the appropriation, we're not able to pay the claims that we're receiving at this point in time, and we have this issue of, are we going to continue to evaluate the claims in the field? We know it's going to cost us more going forward than it has in the past. Okay, and then if you want to go on. And then getting into more things that are more specific to deer, the one thing in particular I would point out on this slide, like I just mentioned, with abatement, resources for abatement are limiting right now. If there was an opportunity to make those resources greater, that would make it easier for more producers to take advantage of them and have them be at the scale where they can be implemented, hopefully successfully. But that's been one of the main challenges here. And then there's opportunities as well, basically just trying to incentivize people to take advantage of hunting opportunities in such a way that it will reduce population pressure of deer in you know, the areas of the state where we need to see the population pressure reduced. So quite a lot of recommendations that DNR was able to bring to the report in ways that could be accomplished. Good. And kind of along the same lines with the last slide. So like I said, there's a lot of detail in the slides. Really just trying to hit the high points here, but happy to answer questions. Yeah.
Thanks, Mr. Abramson. Questions from members? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. So just going back to the map that you have at the very beginning of the presentation, so right now it seems like it is just into the northwest, and then there's the proposed new elk range for, I believe, the Fond du Lac Reservation. And so can you just tell me what is the work that you're currently doing with any of our tribal governments around this issue, and, you know, what is the status of, you know, highlighting that piece around the Fond du Lac Reservation?
Mr. Abramson?
Yeah, thanks for the question. That's a good one. So DNR and Fond du Lac are really leading that effort in terms of the overall planning for that, you know, possible eventual move. Department of Agriculture, we have been participating in terms of, like, how will we handle the damage in that area. Both DNR and Fond du Lac have done a good job of trying to document what are all the types of damages we might anticipate given where the elk would be located, and are, you know, expecting to be reaching out, like, down to the level of individual producers in that area to try and, you know, evaluate how might they be affected, how can we make sure we're proactive in terms of any abatement measures we can take up front, make sure they understand about compensation claims, that, should that come to pass. For us in particular, we're trying to figure out how do we handle a claim in the areas, because we have had our adjusters have all been in the Northwest, and this is going to be way farther than they're going to go. So, again, that's where continuing to work with Wildlife Services would give us that opportunity to have a claim evaluated there as well.
Follow-up question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, then, they're currently not able to get any claims paid through the current process, and then for any future appropriations, are you considering, you know, possibly with, you know, the work to bring them into the process, are we anticipating that in some of the current or future requests for appropriations from the state?
Mr. Abramson.
Yeah, so actually I would say, and it will be, we expect it may be up to as much as 10 years before there would be enough elk in that area that there would actually be damages there, so we have some time. But we have an agreement as of now with Wildlife Services where they're working with us to evaluate claims. They've worked with us on a couple of northwest Minnesota already. So they could respond to a claim now in that area if needed. The problem is that's a temporary agreement, and we're hoping to make it into more of a long-term agreement. So I can't say that beyond our agreement with them now, which ends at the end of June, that we have them in place to do that.
Follow-up question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just going to page 21 of the presentation on the recommendations for the elk damage compensation program. So the last bullet points talk about expand compensation program to cover damage done by deer. And so is this recommendation for all damage through deers for the entire state of Minnesota, or is it just for that zone or that range? And if it's only for that zone and range,
Mr. Abramson,
why is that the case and not for the entire state?
Mr. Abramson?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so in our slide here, we're including recommendations received from all the groups for the report. This was a stakeholder recommendation that we consider, is there a way to include compensation for deer damage as well as elk in that program? It's going to be challenging considering the money that has been appropriated to date for elk. I mean, obviously, it's not covering elk, so it would be very difficult to cover anything for deer. But that was a recommendation we got, is that there should be the potential for compensation for deer as there is for elk.
Seeing no further questions, thank you very much, Mr. Abramson. We'll move along now to House File 601. Representative Burkle, moving up to the table. And Representative, would you care to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 601 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Burkle, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 601 aims to provide compensation to farmers for crop or fence damage caused by elk, as well as livestock killed or injured by wolves. And currently under the Wolf Depredation Program, the Minnesota Department of Ag, as we've heard, compensates livestock owners for animals that are killed or injured by wolves. The compensation amount is based on a fair market value and determined by MDA in consultation with the university extension agents. And back home in Kitson County, of course, as mentioned in the MDA's presentation, the Sheriff's Department has been trained to carry out those assessments as well. So House File 601 is an appropriation for fiscal year 25, addressing the issue that the current funding right now is depleted. And we're kind of backfill that. We have producers up north that aren't able to access those dollars for claims that they've made now, both elk and wolf. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers, if I could.
Very good. We have with us Jake Thompson and Stu Laurie from the Farmers Union. Mr. Thompson, welcome. State your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, fellow committee members. My name is Jake Thompson. I'm president of the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association and also a cow-calf producer located up in Barnesville, Minnesota. I'm here today to testify on House File 605 in support of 601 and House File 271. Cattle producers are struggling greatly with wolf and elk depredation in northern Minnesota and need increased assistance to protect their livelihoods. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture continues running out of funds to reimburse producers for loss of livestock, crop, and fence destruction. At current date, the Minnesota DNR estimates there is over 2,900 wolves in the state of Minnesota, and according to the 2024 USDA Wildlife Services Wolf Conflict in Minnesota Management Report, there was over 252 calls for wolf conflict management assistance related to livestock, poultry, pet owners, and citizens concerned for public safety. Of those 252 complaints, this has been the highest annual number reported and much above the 174 10-year average. A total of 136 of those 252 complaints were verified as wolf kills or injuries to domestic animals, and of those, 128 were livestock and poultry. Cow-calf depredations continue to account for the largest number of those domestic livestock impacted by wolves. Livestock verified as killed by the wolves in Minnesota eligible for compensation, like you just heard from the department. In year 24, they were allocated $175,000, and the department total claims were $187,942. Producers simply cannot be reimbursed where there is no funding for it to be happen. Producers struggling with elk depredation is also not in good position. The department continues running out of funds to reimburse for fence and crop destruction by elk. We have farmers that have financial loss from elk last year, and like you just heard, will probably not be compensated until 2026. At the top of the current elk issues for Northwest farmers are what we just heard too about the transfer with the Fond du Lac tribe from Northwestern herd to the northeastern part of the state, which we are concerned will lead to more damage and once again rising depredation claims that cannot be paid. The Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association is requesting an increase in funding for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture as wolf and elk depredation funds, and we feel this increasing funds is just common sense. Farmers and ranchers in the state deserve to know that they are taken care of. Thank you for your time. I'll answer any questions.
Thanks, Mr. Thompson. Questions from members? Seeing none, next testimony, Mr. Lorry.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stu Lorry, Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. And on behalf of MFU, I'm glad to share our strong support for efforts to provide strong funding for the depredation accounts. I'll start by talking about wolves. This is a big deal. You got a map in your packet of the wolf territory. I need to remember to look at that map before I go visit county meetings, because if I forget to bring it up in those northern counties, I'll be sure to get a pointed question about it. Just a personal experience that's maybe instructive. In fall of 23, I was up with my folks when my dad had a depredation on his farm, actually. We were cresting the hill. He swears he saw the wolf. We went and found a calf that had been killed. And he went through the process to try to get paid out, and ultimately wasn't able to. They said that they couldn't find a wolf track. It was a drought, if you remember, at that time in November. Nothing was leaving tracks, including the cattle. So I tell that story for two reasons. One, just to share that the folks at the Department of Agriculture and our federal partners do their due diligence, and they're definitely checking up on this, but also just to share the perspective of many of our members that there are more depredations that are maybe reflected in those verified kills. I'll also say if I go up to Rep. Burkle's district, I'm certain to get questions about the elk depredation account, and increasingly we're hearing from members in East Central Minnesota about the DNR's proposal to move an elk herd there, and a chief concern is the health of these depredation accounts. So appreciate your consideration, and thanks for the time.
Thank you very much. Next testifier, Hunter, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Hunter Peterson, Minnesota Farm Bureau. On top of what everyone else has said, I would just add that, farmers and ranchers have limited management options when it comes to wolves in particular, with elk too, but just because of their protected status under federal and state law. Minnesota has more wolves than all the other lower 48 states combined, and there is still ongoing interest in expanding both the wolf and elk populations in Minnesota. So on top of the current payment shortfall that others have referenced, I would just say that if it's the state's position to maintain or grow the current wolf and elk populations, that it would only be fair that funding for depredation payments is commensurate, just to ensure that farmers and ranchers are fairly compensated for losses of livestock, crops, and fencing. So thank you, Representative Burkle, for carrying the bill, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions for testifiers? Seeing none, thank you. Have a couple of amendments. The A1, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am not going to move the A1 or the A2 amendment, but I want, I'd ask members to read them. And the rationale, if we listen to the report and listen to the presentations, we actually have a broken system that the federal government, the people who do the validation on the wolves, the people who may do culling of wolves, may no longer be employed and may never be employed again. And, here we are moving another bill You know, it's kind of interesting, Republican bills on spending, at the same time there's slashing at the federal level. I think on elk, we have a different question. And let me go back to wolves for a moment. It's not surprising to have stakeholders ask for more money without abatement or conditions. That's not unique. But when we have a broken system, like if there is no federal validation, no people to come out and say, is this a wolf kill? If they're not there anymore, how are we going to run this program? If we are in the red with the next budget forecast, where do we find the money for this or other programs? So there are programs for livestock compensation through, there are insurance products. I did just a simple check on buying livestock risk management insurance that can be covered by for wildlife kills. That's different than when this program was set up. And it's but it's similar to what we've dealt with in the federal government, where we used to have annual disaster bills and move towards crop insurance and subsidize the crop insurance. And so what my amendments do, and I probably wasn't artful in crafting them, on my fault, but on wolves, if you have a product, an insurance product, is there a different way to do this where maybe we start up and provide assistance for a livestock risk management commercial product that we cover that coverage? Because if we continue this way, we may not have the dollars. Secondly, if the wolf is delisted and we have no federal, how do we continue this particular program if we revert to existing law, which I believe provides for a season on wolves? Do we continue this program? So your bill has a 2025, taking this current fiscal year for wolves and for elk. I think we have a great deal of uncertainty, but what we do know is certain is that the status quo is probably not going to happen. And how do we change that? So I am putting these out here as ways of changing it, that hopefully in the committee we could have those discussions and see if we can do this a different way. On elk, I'm very concerned that we don't have anybody to validate the claims that we heard in the report. We went from 5 down to 1, and now there are none. And so, and I'm more skeptical on crop insurance covering the loss if you don't have people trained in determining elk damage. But how do we provide protection? Maybe it's the abatement clause, or maybe it's something, but if we have to come back every year and add 100K here, another 100K, we're going to be in a very large situation on the taxpayer side in terms of money. So the amendments both on this bill and on the next bill are designed to take into account on wolves, what if it goes off the list, and how do we deal with the federal loss? And on the elk, how do we deal with the loss of validators to determine if there is actual damage?
Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, can I comment on that quick?
Representative Burkle.
I'd agree with you, Representative Hansen, that the system is broken, and I have a bill for that. If you want to sign on, it's House File 649. That would require a wolf hunt. I think the wolf management plan, as we've seen, is flawed, and the numbers are high. Maybe thinning some of that out and actually managing our wolves in the state would solve some of the problem right there. As far as the elk program goes and the elk abatement you mentioned, I think there's definitely some room to have a discussion there. But in particular, it's hard when you're talking about a soybean field. 40 acres of soybeans destroyed overnight by an elk herd. I mean, we can talk about abatement when we're talking about forage stored in an area. I get that. There's conversation to be had around that. But as far as fencing and a soybean crop, for instance, there's a different conversation to be had around that. In either case, though, the situation, the fact that the $20,000 cap has been in place since 1987, there's just obvious flaws in the program. We can talk about that more later. But I just wanted to comment on those two points.
Okay, we have 6 minutes remaining and one bill to go. Representative Smith.
I'll be quick, Chair Anderson. Thank you. And this might be a question even for you over Representative Burkle. I'm just trying to get a handle on this. We had a this is going to Ways. I assume it will pass to Ways. We had a bill earlier go to Ways with not a specified amount of money in it, mm-hmm. not unheard of, so that it's a vehicle bill. But why are we moving this bill specifically with funding already mentioned to Ways now when we're waiting on the previous bills? I'm just trying to get my head around why, at this point, we're moving this. But I have nothing against the program. The program is a good program.
Merkel.
Well, I'm trying to understand your question. You're wondering why there's – we're talking about House File 601, correct?
Yes.
So 601 is $250,000, $125,000 each for Elk and Wolf for this year because they run out of money. So we're getting it the ways it means to get that money to the Department of Ag as soon as possible to fulfill those claims in northwest Minnesota.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. I do get that's the kind of hard of my question, though. I understand getting it quickly, but there's also, I mean, there's a lot of programs I imagine that could use that. I mean, we just talked about avian flu testing that had to be delayed because they were afraid of federal funds, maybe shoring that up. It's just interesting that this is coming up when with specific amounts that we're going to move to Ways and Means when we're not quite ready with our full budget. It's worth pointing that out. I don't need an answer unless you want to say something. That's fine. And to be clear, it's a good program. I have nothing against the program. It's just that's notable.
Thanks, Representative Smith. Any further questions? If not, Representative Burkle renews his motion that this bill be passed, House File 601. It referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
The ayes have it. The bill is passed. Next item is House File 271. Representative Burkle, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 271 be put before the committee. I'm assuming we're laying this over.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, we are.
Once again, same spiel, different bill. But this bill just provides compensation and open appropriation for the next budget cycle. As you heard from MDA, there's questions about what kind of funding we need, given the fact that we've got a $20,000 cap that's very old, and we continue to run out of money in the wolf and elk depredation programs. I would remind everyone that specifically in my area, since 2020 through 2024, I think just wolves alone, $148,000 plus, and then of course all the elk money comes from my district or is in my district. So the bill would just set up the account for the next budget cycle and allow for depredation programs in wolves and elk to continue.
Questions from members? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Burkle, if there is a loss of a cow or a sheep or two wolf, or if there is crop loss, let's just deal with the wolf for right now. Can that be deducted on tax year end on an income tax? Or can you show the loss on your taxes?
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rep. Hanson. Can you show the loss of the animal on your taxes?
He's shaking his head yes.
I believe so. Yeah.
No, I was asking.
Okay, yeah, but he would return the question.
I would have to check on that, actually. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
Representative Hanson. Representative Nelson, phone a friend.
I'll answer that. I do not believe you can, and if we can, then I'm going to be a little upset if my accountant.
Any further questions from members? And I appreciate your indulgence to picking up the pace a bit. No questions? No call for a roll call, I assume. So yeah, this bill is going to be laid over, Representative Burkle. You want to make that motion?
All right, I'll renew my motion to put House File 71 to be laid over.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, the bill has been is laid over. And we had one final presentation. We apologize again to CeluComp. We will reschedule them at a later date. Thank you, members, for your work today. And with that, 1 minute early, the meeting is adjourned.